From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Para reconocer su respaldo al
to acknowledge support for the lifting of the illegal economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the United States against Cuba, which has been intensified deliberately and opportunistically during pandemic conditions. Despite being condemned for decades by the overwhelming majority of the international community.
Denouncing the United States for intensifying its economic blockade while the island nation is facing a surge in COVID cases and deaths. We'll speak to a leading Cuban diplomat about the embargo, the pandemic, and calls for a new regional bloc in Latin America to counter U.S. influence. Then we go to Central America to look at how a drug trafficking mayor in Honduras fueled the U.S. migration crisis. And we speak to a mother in Texas suing Republican Governor Greg Abbott over his executive order banning face mask mandates in schools.
This has become so politicized, and it's really the, in my opinion, the very simplest thing that we should all be able to agree on, which is the health and education of children, and no parent should have to choose between the two.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In New York, heads of state addressed the United Nations General Assembly Tuesday as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned, quote, we are on the edge of an abyss, unquote, as the world faces the mounting crises of the pandemic, inequity, conflict, and the climate catastrophe. At his General Assembly debut, President Biden called for unity and diplomacy, though critics say his administration's rhetoric and actions are stirring up a new Cold War with China. Biden also addressed the climate crisis.
The scientists and experts are telling us that we're fast approaching a point of no return in a literal sense. To keep within our reach the vital goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, every nation needs to bring their highest possible ambitions to the table when we meet in Glasgow for COP26.
President Biden pledged to double U.S. aid to poorer countries bearing the brunt of the climate crisis. But activists say Biden's promises are far too meager, considering the U.S. is historically the world's worst polluter. In other climate pledges, Chinese President Xi Jinping announced China will stop funding new coal-fired power plants overseas and will help develop low-carbon energy sources in poorer nations. South Korean President Moon Jae-in called for a declaration to end the Korean War and for talks to resume with North Korea. Peru's recently elected president, Pedro Castillo, said he came as a representative of the poor and the marginalized and called for vaccine equity to overcome the pandemic.
On behalf of Peru, I want to propose the signing of a global agreement between heads of state and the owners of patents to guarantee universal access to vaccines for all people on the planet with no discrimination on the basis of privilege.
Iran's new leader, Ibrahim Raisi, said nuclear talks should lead to the lifting of brutal U.S. sanctions on Iran.
Sanctions, and especially sanctions on medicine at the time of COVID-19 pandemic, are crimes against humanity.
Meanwhile, Brazil's health minister is tested positive for COVID-19 just hours after he accompanied President Jair Bolsonaro, who is unvaccinated, to the UN General Assembly. House Democrats passed a bill Tuesday evening to avert a government shutdown and suspend the debt limit. But with less than 2 weeks before a September 30th deadline to keep funding the government, Senate Republicans have said they will not support a suspension of the debt ceiling, meaning critical funding for health, housing, education and other programs could still be interrupted and some federal workers could stop receiving paychecks. The bill also funds emergency recovery assistance for recent climate disasters and for resettling Afghan refugees. Under pressure from progressive lawmakers, Democrats removed $1 billion in Israeli military funding from the stopgap bill, though Democratic leaders said funding for the Iron Dome missile defense system would still be passed separately at a later date. In other news from Washington, D.C., Congressmember Cori Bush and Senator Elizabeth Warren have introduced legislation that would reinstate the federal pandemic eviction moratorium and give the Health and Human Services Department permanent authority to enact an eviction ban during public health crises. The bill was unveiled at an anti-eviction rally Tuesday outside Congress, led by people who've been evicted or are facing eviction. This is Vivian Smith, a leader with the Miami Worker Center.
I've been forced to choose between food, rent, too many times. Many of us had to make the choice of the choices between our health or our homes. The rent eats first.
That ain't right.
Johnson & Johnson said Tuesday an additional dose of its COVID-19 vaccine boosts its efficacy to 94% in mild to severe infections, up from 74% for just one shot. The J&J shot also has longer-lasting efficacy than the mRNA vaccines authorized in the United States, this according to a recent study. J&J says their data still needs to be reviewed by the FDA before any recommendations can be made about a second dose. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization once again warned against wealthy nations offering booster shots for the general population, with so many countries still lacking basic access to vaccines. Elsewhere, the northern Chinese city of Harbin has ordered recreational facilities and religious venues to shut down after a single case of COVID-19 was identified in the city of 10 million. The move is part of China's zero-tolerance approach to stamping out new outbreaks of the virus. Mexican authorities have started violently apprehending and rounding up Haitian asylum seekers who left an unsafe makeshift encampment in Del Rio, Texas, to return to Mexico. It's believed they may be sent to a massive immigrant detention camp in southern Mexico. Meanwhile, the Biden administration continues its mass deportation of Haitian asylum seekers, expelling hundreds of them since Sunday without due process under the Trump-era Title 42 policy. Back in Washington, D.C., immigrant communities, advocates and allies took to the streets to demand the government provide a pathway to citizenship for millions of people and pass legislation protecting workers and combating the climate crisis. The march came 2 days after the Senate parliamentarian ruled Democrats could not include a pathway to citizenship as part of its reconciliation package.
Millions of immigrants work every day to provide a better future for our families. We're essential to the country's economy, yet we're still forced to live in the shadows. We're tired of living in fear of deportations, of being separated from our loved ones. A path to citizenship would change my life and would change the lives of many of us here today protesting.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Minnesota Congressmember Ilhan Omar also addressed the crowd at the event. The bodies of at least 8 refugees, including one child, have washed up on the shores of Spain's Mediterranean coast between Sunday and Tuesday. Local authorities say the refugees likely came from one or more boats that capsized after setting off on a dangerous journey from Morocco or Algeria. The UN says at least 238 refugees fleeing extreme poverty, displacement and violence have died this year as they attempt to reach Spain for safety. The local rights groups estimate the number is far higher. In more news from Spain, about 6,000 people have been evacuated from the island of La Palma, part of the Canary Islands, as the Cumbre Vieja volcano continues to erupt. Today, lava poured from the volcano for a fourth straight day since Sunday, burying homes in its path. Scientists warn the eruption and its aftermath could last up to 3 months, and that if lava reaches the sea, it could trigger more explosions and clouds of toxic gases. In reproductive news, Texas has enacted yet another law restricting abortion rights by barring doctors from providing medication to induce an abortion after only 7 weeks into a pregnancy. Anyone who violates the law faces a state felony offense up to 2 years in jail and a fine of up to $10,000. NARAL Pro-Choice America said, quote, anti-choice politicians have made their intentions abundantly clear and they'll stop at nothing to strip away reproductive freedom, they said. Senator Bernie Sanders joined healthcare advocates at a protest outside the headquarters of Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, Pharma, one of Big Pharma's top lobbying groups, demanding an end to the for-profit drug industry and for drug corporations to stop meddling in Congress. This is Senator Sanders.
While the pharmaceutical industry charges us the highest prices in the world, while one out of four Americans cannot afford the medicine they need, what we are seeing is that every year the drug companies are making outrageous profits and are paying their executives obscene levels of compensation.
House Democrats unveiled the Protecting Our Democracy Act Tuesday, which they said would help rein in presidential powers and abuses of power following the Trump administration. The legislation would impose new restrictions on presidential pardons, protect watchdogs and inspectors general from firings or other retaliation, make it more difficult for presidents to refuse congressional subpoenas, to circumvent congressional appropriations, and to make profits from the office of the presidency. The New York Times reports Donald Trump's reelection campaign was aware that claims by Trump's lawyers that 2020 voting machines were rigged were unfounded. Just days after the campaign determined the voting fraud conspiracies had no merit, Sidney Powell and Rudolph Giuliani held a news conference where they continued to level the false claims. Meanwhile, the new book by Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa says a lawyer on Trump's legal team tried to convince then-Vice President Mike Pence that he could overturn Trump's election law by throwing out electors from seven states. And Caribbean political philosopher Charles Mills has died at the age of 70. A longtime educator, Mills was most recently Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at CUNY, the City University of New York. His landmark book, The Racial Contract, challenged the deracialized framework of the social contract. Mills wrote, quote, "White supremacy is the unnamed political system that has made the modern world what it is today." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Cuba's denouncing the United States for intensifying its economic blockade, while the island's facing a surge in COVID cases and deaths. We'll speak to a leading Cuban diplomat about the embargo, the pandemic, and calls for a new regional bloc in Latin America to counter U.S. influence. Stay with us. Point by Selena Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, as President Biden called on global leaders at the United Nations yesterday to work together on combating the climate crisis and the COVID pandemic, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is pushing Latin American and Caribbean nations to form a new European Union-style bloc to counter U.S. influence across the hemisphere. AMLO made the call during a meeting of the Community of Latin American Caribbean States in Mexico City, attended by regional leaders, including the presidents of Cuba and Venezuela. He criticized the outsized influence the U.S. has on the Organization of American States and denounced the U.S. embargo of Cuba.
It is time to end the lethargy and establish a new and vigorous relationship between the people of America. It seems to me that it is time to replace the policy of blockades and mistreatment with the option of respecting each other, walking together, and associating ourselves for the good of America without violating our sovereignty.
At the regional meeting, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel criticized the United States for intensifying its blockade at a time when Cuba is facing a surge in COVID cases and deaths.
To acknowledge support for the lifting of the illegal economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the United States against Cuba, which has been intensified deliberately and opportunistically during pandemic conditions, despite being condemned for decades by the overwhelming majority of the international community.
The regional meeting comes as Cuba's playing a growing role in combating the COVID pandemic globally. Just this week, Vietnam signed a deal to buy 10 million doses of a Cuban-made vaccine. Cuba's also at the forefront globally of vaccinating children. Cuba recently began vaccinating children as young as 2 years old. We're joined now by Carlos Fernandez de Castillo. He is Director General for U.S. Affairs in the Cuban Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He's the former Cuban ambassador to South Africa and also to Canada. He's in New York for the United Nations General Assembly. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So let's talk about what your island is experiencing right now. It's the worst COVID surge you've experienced to date. It still doesn't compare to the United States, which is at about 490 deaths. 490 deaths in the population, yours at 1,500. Can you talk about what's happening in your island? It's about three times better, if all cases are being reported, of deaths in the United States.
Well, we coped quite successfully during 2020. With the pandemic, our figures were very, very low, thanks to the robust public health system in the country that was able to, through preventive measures, epidemiological preventive measures, to cope with the pandemic. But beginning in the first quarter of this year, with the introduction of the Delta variant, we started to have a surge that has plateaued since July, and it's at this moment has plateaued. And there's no way for us to deal with it without vaccinating the population in order to get the herd immunity that one needs to confront this. The fact that we were able to develop our own vaccines, we have four vaccines at this moment which are being applied, it has allowed us to put a limit in the amount of contagious infections. We have begun to reduce the amount of daily deaths, and we believe we should be out of the problem by the end of the year. Our plan is to end November with practically the whole population vaccinated.
I just wanted to clarify, in the U.S., it's around 1 in 490 people have died of COVID, and in Cuba, it's around 1 in 1,500. Juan?
Yes, Ambassador, I wanted to ask you, what's been the strategy or approach of Cuba toward the vaccines compared to what's been happening in the industrialized West? And what advice would you have, your country have, to those countries that are, and to the companies like Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J, which are resisting technology transfers to make the vaccine as available as possible?
Well, our approach was to begin the process of finding a vaccine very early. In the month of March of 2020, when we still did not have anyone infected in Cuba, our president led an effort to try to produce vaccines. Even during the months of several months during 2020, when it seemed that we were able to control it just by the public health system, he insisted that we needed to do it because this virus could replicate, it could change, and we could have other pandemics, and we need to try to make an effort to develop. And that's why we have four vaccines. One of our aims also is to, and the reason why we can be able to vaccinate children as young as 2 years old, is that from the very beginning, the concept was that we needed a vaccine that could be applied to children because of the important role in the dissemination of viruses and the fact that we need to protect the whole population. Now, we think that the international effort should be to share, that this is not an issue for the great transnational corporations or the big transnational corporations to profit and to find that there's a great business opportunity here. We're facing a huge problem. A huge problem doesn't seem to go away easily. And unless there's a concerted effort of solidarity, for all to be vaccinated, the world will be with a big problem for a long time.
And could you talk to us also about the impact on the island of your public health efforts? For instance, what has been the situation with public schools? Have you been able to keep the schools open? And also, since Cuba depends a lot on tourism, what's been the economic impact of so many countries shutting down travel?
The impact has been huge. But I should begin by saying that we were forced, as part of the measures that we took early on in 2020, to close schools and close businesses and to reduce the amount of people-to-people contact in the country as a way to prevent the circulation of the virus. And to this day, schools have been shut. Children are not attending school. Universities are not having presence there. We have been using the national television system to continue education so that children can be continue in school. Universities have had to find ways of doing education and classes at a distance so it doesn't shut down. But to this moment, we have not been able to go back as a presence to school. We plan to be able to do so some moment between the end of the year, perhaps mid-October, perhaps end of November, sometime there, depending on the figures and on the facts as they come out. But we are sure that it is essential to avoid contact and to spread the virus, and we need to make that sacrifice.
I wanted to ask,
and in terms of
go ahead,
in terms of tourism?
And, oh, that's another point. Thank you. We had to shut the entrance of the country, and that has had a huge impact on the main source of income of our country. So we've had to cope with the pandemic, with having to shut the sources of income of our economy, spending huge amounts of money in medicine, in keeping people in hospitals, has been a big burden. And if you add to that the fact that the U.S. government chose to see in the COVID pandemic an ally in their aggression against Cuba, it's been a huge problem for us to cope with the issue. To give you an idea, it is prohibited by law in the U.S. to export oxygen to Cuba or to export medicine. You could get a license after very troublesome negotiations with companies that would be ready to run the risk of doing business with Cuba. But in practical terms, it is prohibited for Cuba to import medicines, to import raw material, to import oxygen equipment from the U.S. to be able to face a huge problem like this one, or to buy those equipments or those medicines anywhere in the world if it has up to 10% of U.S. technology parts or items of origin.
I wanted to ask you about another health issue. The House of Representatives yesterday unanimously passed a bill authorizing additional support for U.S. officials who were injured in a series of mysterious episodes that caused traumatic brain injuries. It's called Havana Syndrome because that's where it was first identified. But it has gone far beyond that. I mean, you have U.S. diplomats and CIA officers who've been injured in China, Central Asian countries, Europe, including Vienna, two possible episodes in the United States. The Cuban government has been cooperating with the U.S. government in looking for what is the cause of this. Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, just had a meeting with infuriated intelligence officials who were sickened by this, perhaps unfairly called Havana Syndrome. What are your thoughts on it?
You mentioned that Cuba has been cooperating with the U.S. government. I would think the correct term would be that we have been trying to cooperate with the U.S. government. There hasn't been much effort or welcoming from the U.S. government from the very beginning. Over 3 years have gone by. The U.S. government has no answer to explain what has happened. Many of the theories that have been put out there, sometimes under a scientific banner, have been highly questioned by the scientific community of Cuba, of the U.S., of many parts of the world. Some of them simply cannot overcome the challenge of physics or known science, like having ultrasound or infrasound or weapons that can damage one person, which is in the same room as another one, without having any physical or visible effect. Very recently, a group of elite scientists from Cuba published an article trying to defeat many of the theories that have gone through. But in the past 4 years, the U.S. government has not been able to come up with an answer. It's like one of those mysteries that go around in the United States and which remain unsolved and that are politically manipulated. The use of the term Havana Syndrome is deliberate. It has a lot of weight to try to single out Cuba as a place that is unsafe for American officials, which is totally untrue. Totally untrue, and there have been many inconsistencies in what the U.S. government has said, and yet it's not put to a challenge.
Ambassador, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the policies of the Biden administration toward Cuba, you know, one of the most little remarked results of the U.S. Census is not only the increase of the Latino population in the United States, but the enormous increase in the Venezuelan population, about 126% increase in the number of Venezuelans in the United States in the last 10 years. Do you have a sense that this new, and of course, this hasn't gotten as much attention as the Central American increase in population, but I'm wondering, do you have a sense that the Biden administration is still kowtowing to not only the remnants of the old right-wing Cuban population in the United States, but also now this growing Venezuelan population?
The Biden administration policy towards Cuba today has been the Trump administration policy toward Cuba. There's no change whatsoever. The government said that it was going to revise, that the revision is going in place, by which it separates itself from the, at least it gives the impression of separating from the Trump approach, but at the same time applying faithfully the same policy that Trump designed against Cuba. It's a policy that does not reflect the points of view of the majority of Americans. It does not reflect necessarily the point of view of the majority of Cuban Americans. I can't speak about what Venezuelans who live in the United States believe. But what most people tell us, and again, this is what we are told, is that there's a lot of political calculation. There's no U.S. strategic interest. There's no U.S. strategic priority being met by the policy towards Cuba. It's purely and simple crude politics related to southern Florida. This is what we are being told.
On Tuesday at the UN, President Biden briefly referenced Cuba during his address to the General Assembly.
The truth is, the democratic world is everywhere. It lives in the anti-corruption activists, the human rights defenders, the journalists, the peace protesters. On the front lines of this struggle in Belarus, Burma, Syria, Cuba, Venezuela, and everywhere in between.
So can you respond, Carlos Fernandez de Castillo, to what he is referencing? Also, the mass protests that erupted throughout the island, throughout Cuba, and the criticism of the response of the Cuban government to arrest so many.
That's a long question. Or for a long answer. First, he forgot to mention the U.S. in that list that he used at the U.N., where there are problems of democracy, where there are people asking for their rights, defending different legitimate concerns. He forgot to mention the United States and many of its allies in that list. On the 11th of July in Cuba, not during the month of July, on that day specifically, on the 11th of July, there were groups of people who demonstrated in Cuba. You cannot say it was massive. It was in 11 communities in Cuba. And there was a mixture of people who were peacefully expressing their concerns, frustration of a genuinely very difficult situation in Cuba, the combination of the pandemics, of economic hardships, which included electrical power cuts, problems of the availability of foodstuffs, increase in prices in some areas, which are typical of an economic crisis through which Cuba is going on today, and that it's not unique to Cuba. What's unique to Cuba is that a lot of it is made by the U.S. government. Not all, but a lot of it is made by the U.S. government. That's what's singular about Cuba. But that occurred in Cuba, and you have the combination of that with people that wanted to violently act against the government. Over 40 commercial entities in Cuba were vandalized, windows broken, things stolen, a clinic was attacked. People suffered aggression from some of the demonstrators, not the great majority of them, but some of the demonstrators. So people have been called into detention. Some have been prosecuted. Some will be doing time in prison. Many have been fined. It's a process that occurs in many countries. That has been the subject of a comprehensive and massive propaganda campaign against Cuba. First, trying to allege that Cuba was weeks or months undergoing massive rallies and protests, which is not true. Secondly, that there were people disappeared in Cuba, which is not true. Thirdly, that we were incarcerating minors, not true. Fourth, that we were torturing people, not true. If one looks at the scenes that were put on television, and there were many trying to exaggerate what happened in Cuba, and one saw the use of police force, the legitimate use of police force, it's very mild compared to the typical use of police force that you see in cities in the United States, in cities across Europe, across Latin America, in many countries. If you do an objective and real comparison, not if you're under the impression of what the media is trying to portray. There were pictures in main media organizations of Alexandria, Egypt, of Buenos Aires, of different parts, trying to portray them as massive rallies in Cuba. The greatest amount of people that went out on the streets on July 11 were people who went out in support of the revolution. Now, you won't find that in most digital networks. You won't find it in the mass media. They were not the first ones to come out, but the majority of those that came out were in support of the government and in support of the Cuban revolution.
Interestingly, Fox got caught using pro-government protesters as B-roll, as anti-government protesters, but blurring out their signs. Juan.
But it wasn't only Fox. Others did the same.
Ambassador, I'd like to ask you about this recent announcement by Mexican President López Obrador calling for a new regional bloc in Latin America. Clearly, this has been attempted in the past, and President Hugo Chávez attempted to develop regional blocs as well. Do you see any prospect for success this time around?
We will have to see. It is evident that the OAS is an outdated organization. It's an organization created by the U.S. in 1948 at the height of the Cold War. It's an organization that is tainted, that has a very bad legacy in support of coup d'etats, in support of some of the most repressive regimes in the region, including those that have assassinated thousands of people, and as a legacy, as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy in a region, which is a foreign policy of the Monroe Doctrine of domination of the Western Hemisphere. In 2011, the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean, the 33 nations, for the first time, a region that is independent since the 19th century, for the first time came up with an organization, CELAC, that represents exclusively the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean, and inclusively, I say, all the nations, without exclusion whatsoever. CELAC is an organization that belongs to us. It truly represents our region, as a difference to the OAS, which is an organization to which Cuba does not belong, by the way, but that includes Canada and the U.S., and it's an area where the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean could deal with the U.S. and Canada. The call by the president of Mexico is an expression of a feeling that exists in the region, that is shared by most governments of the region. But it depends on the popularity of the governments in place, what the peoples in each of the nations request from the governments. And we hope that in the future of our region, we will continue to consolidate an organization that represents us as a whole and that gives us an idea without any foreign interference.
I wanted to ask you about the shocking images we've seen from Del Rio, Texas, where Border Patrol on horseback have been filmed chasing, grabbing, whipping Haitian asylum seekers. One border agent was heard screaming obscenities at the refugees, including children, as they attempted to return to a makeshift camp where thousands had been staying underneath a bridge for days. I'm wondering if you can comment on the situation. You talked about the Biden administration not changing policy towards Cuba from Trump, even though Biden was the vice president for Obama, who was starting to normalize relations with Cuba. You also have the same situation on the border, where the Biden administration is continuing the Trump-era policies, in fact, surpassing when it comes to deportations and expulsions of refugees and asylum seekers. Then you have Mexico cracking down on these Haitian asylum seekers as they return from the 15,000 crowds under the Del Rio Bridge. And you have our Department of Homeland Security head, Mayorkas, who is a Cuban-American. Your thoughts, Carlos Fernandez de Castillo.
Well, the images are impressive. They are dramatic. It is an expression of the way migrants are treated in the border. And on many occasions, a double standard of U.S. policy that uses migrants because the U.S. economy needs them, and at the same time is very repressive in the border. The government, the Biden government has expressed on several occasions, even though one doesn't see much of a practical impact, that migration is not an issue of just people wanting to choose to go to the United States. There are social, economic, and sometimes political conditions that urge people, that move people to migrate to the United States. UN, that if development doesn't really trickle down, underdevelopment will continue creeping north. And that is much of what's happening with Latin America. In the specific case of Haiti, one has to understand that there's a historical trajectory of racism against Haiti. The Western world has always been unforgiving for the only slave insurrection of Africans in the world. And the only one, and the first one, the only one successful that was able to get a government in our region. And there also always been that kind of prejudice against Haiti, which is something that's unacceptable. And these images are, to some extent, a show of that. We understand that migration is a huge issue for the United States. In the case of Cuba, we have agreements in place from decades ago, and the Trump administration chose not to comply with them, and the Biden administration has continued the same approach, not to comply with very important migratory agreements that we have between the two countries, specifically to avoid the kind of crisis that in the case of Cuba that you're seeing today in the border of Mexico and that at some occasions we have seen in the Florida Strait. Those are important agreements. We stand by them, but for them to be able to fulfill their role, there has to be two countries, both complying with what has been committed.
We're going to thank you so much for being with us. Last answer, 10 seconds. Biden holding a major COVID summit today alongside the United Nations General Assembly. Is Cuba represented there? And what are your demands of this summit?
We would demand for the U.S. government to leave us in peace and not to have COVID as an ally and as an instrument of aggression against Cuba, making life difficult for us and making it difficult for Cuba to cope with the pandemic.
Carlos Fernandez de Castillo, Director General for U.S. Affairs in the Cuban Ministry of Foreign Affairs, former Cuban ambassador to South Africa and to Canada. Thanks so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we talk about Honduras and how a drug Honduras mayor, a drug trafficking Honduran mayor, led to the Great Migration from Honduras. Stay with us.
Biamani tunu gana na lagate banyago Biamani tunu na lagate banyago Ambo kura hawa kuhana nyebe uribanie Igira humanya Dagata humanya Igira humanya ni tunu humuwa Dagata humanya Igira humanya Igira humanya ni tunu humuwa
Music by Aurelio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez Alvarado is in New York today, where he's scheduled to address the U.N. General Assembly. His trip comes less than 6 months after a federal court in New York sentenced his brother Tony to life in prison for drug trafficking. U.S. prosecutors listed the Honduran president as a co-conspirator in the state-sponsored drug trafficking. We turn now to a new Reuters special report looking at corruption in the drug trade in Honduras. It's titled, How a Drug Trafficking Mayor in Honduras Fueled the U.S. Migration Crisis. We're joined now by Laura Gottesdiener, who wrote the piece, a correspondent in Reuters Mexico and Central America Bureau, former Democracy Now! Producer. She's joining us from Monterrey, Mexico. And we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Adriana Beltran, executive director of the Seattle International Foundation. Laura, congratulations on this investigative piece. Why don't you lay out what you found?
Sure, and thank you so much for having me. We spent about the last 6 months looking into some of the effects of essentially one small municipality along the border with Guatemala in western Honduras. And we were interested in taking a look at this specific area because it's one of the places where a number of the different factors that appear to be pushing forced displacement, forced migration from Honduras were embodied in this former mayor, Alexander Ardón, and confessed drug trafficker, who ruled as the elected mayor. He did confess to buying votes and carrying out fraud in that election, but he ruled as the elected mayor for 8 years, from 2006 to 2014. He had, according to his testimony in the Southern District of New York, as part of these ongoing drug trials against a number of now confessed drug traffickers from Honduras, he had very close ties to the ruling National Party. He has confessed to, both presidents have denied it, but he has confessed to donating millions of dollars to the election campaigns of both the current Honduran president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, as well as the former president, Lobo. He also, again, according to his testimony, was the link between, or helped facilitate some of the links between El Chapo Guzman, obviously the convicted Mexican drug trafficker, and the highest echelons of the National Party in Honduras, including, according to his testimony, facilitating a $1 million payment for Juan Orlando Hernandez's campaign. So what we were interested in is obviously, I mean, you know, if you step back, you know, no one disputes that if a drug trafficker is the mayor of your town, that that is a bad thing, you know. But what we really wanted to say is how and is this linked to migration out of this region and out of Honduras more broadly, if we understand this to be a phenomenon that, you know, is replicated in various parts of Honduras. And so what we wanted to look at is essentially how did the fact that this mayor, Alexander Ardón, transformed his border municipality into one of the principal drug trafficking corridors in Honduras. How did that affect you if you had nothing to do with the drug trade and you just wanted to keep living in what was always a neglected by the government, central government, and a poor region of the country? And what we found is that his time in office, his 8 years serving as mayor, as well as the many more years in which he was a major trafficker in western Honduras, fundamentally shifted the job prospects, the land ownership in that area. And what we found was that this was an area, a very rural area, primarily people engaged in subsistence farming, as well as the coffee industry. And what we found was that this mayor, and this is a phenomenon that many excellent anthropologists have looked into and see that is replicated across parts of Latin America. We saw that he and his associates essentially bought up large swaths of land that had previously been dedicated to the coffee crop, raised those, essentially destroyed those farms and turned it into cattle grazing areas because cattle is essentially requires large tracts of pasture land, which allows one to essentially have a hassle-free corridor for trafficking cocaine. This is not something unique to this one municipality, but what we found was that when the number or the area under cultivation for coffee fell, both in this municipality as well as all of the surrounding municipalities, the number of jobs available to day laborers, landless families, fell dramatically. And, you know, according to human rights experts and many migrants that we interviewed, both in the municipality of El Paraíso in Copan, Honduras, as well as people traveling through Mexico, as well as people living in the United States, that fueled their need to migrate because their essential, their source of income and their livelihood had dried up.
And Laura, it's what's especially revealing about your article is this connection to what's happening, not only in terms of insecurity and drug trafficking for the populations, but also of the loss of jobs. I mentioned earlier in the show that the Census Bureau report showed that there'd been 26% increase in the Venezuelan population, but the second greatest increase among Latino groups in the country over the last 10 years has been in the number of Hondurans and Guatemalans, over a million Hondurans now in the United States, over a million Guatemalans now in the United States. And so much of this has been in the last 10 years after the coup that occurred in Honduras in 2009. And most Americans don't seem to make the connection between what happened there and why so many Hondurans are appearing at the border. Your thoughts, you interviewed one family, the Batista family. Can you talk about them as well?
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Juan. I think that it's incredibly important sort of to see this period of Honduran migration, which is distinct from other migrations from Central America, from Guatemala or from El Salvador, for example, because we're really seeing the majority of the people who are now living in the United States coming in the last 10 years. So, for example, you know, this year, according to CBP data, approximately 250,000 Hondurans attempted to enter the United States. Similar figures for 2019. So really, we're seeing a dramatic increase of people who, from when I speak to them, and Monterrey, Mexico is part of a major city in one of the many different routes migrants take through Mexico. But people really describe feeling that their life has become unlivable in Honduras. And that was certainly, that is certainly the case for many members of the Bautista family. I had the opportunity to meet one member of the Bautista family, Milton, here in Monterrey as he was reaching the Texas border, and he stopped here in Monterrey for a short period of time. And, you know, as we talked and as we conducted an interview outside of the shelter, you know, he described having left home at 13. He's now 24, so it was over 10 years ago, because his family, his father had been killed under circumstances that were never resolved just before Alexander Ardón took office in El Paraíso, and already as the drug triad was increasing, that as the oldest son, even though he was quite young at the time, sparked a lot of fear for his mother and for him, you know, about the possibility of increased sort of threats to his life. His family, like other families in rural areas, first fled to a major city. They fled to San Pedro Sula. His mother was working as a woman who washed clothes. But, you know, San Pedro Sula in those years had an incredible amount, continues to, but had an incredible amount of insecurity, violence, obviously low wages for internal migrants, people who had fled from the countryside. She came back to El Paraíso, and in that those years, she found that the town, that the area had really transformed, and other members of her family, all of whom are not landless. They own an incredibly small plot of land, but not enough to make subsistence farming a reality to live on, all of whom worked in the coffee crop. And as the area, as the jobs in the coffee industry really evaporated, and again, it's worth saying these were never high-paying jobs, but they made a living off of it. one after another member of the family, including many as teenagers, tried to reach the United States. Some now successfully live in the United States. According to family members, one father and his one-year-old child disappeared along this very dangerous migration route. Others have been expelled back into Mexico or deported back to Honduras. So it's really the story of a family that over the course of 10, 15 years has found what was already a poor area to become an unlivable area in their assessment and has really fueled forced displacement as they see it. Milton and other members of the family told me they had never intended to leave where they're from.
I wanted to bring Adriana Beltran into this conversation, executive director of the Seattle International Foundation. This whole issue of the U.S. support for these governments, like Juan Orlando Hernandez, whose brother's now in prison for life in the United States. He himself was named as a co-conspirator in this, the president of Honduras. And you have Juan famously asking Hillary Clinton when she was running for president in 2000, way back when she spoke to the New York Daily News editorial board about the U.S. support for the coup in Honduras that deposed the democratically elected Zelaya and brought in these governments. Talk about that history.
Sure. Well, and first of all, I just want to congratulate Laura for her brilliant piece. I think it describes and illustrates, bring attention very clearly to this nexus between politics, organized crime in Honduras. That's a problem across the region. And as you say, Amy, you know, to a large extent, the crisis that you continue to see in Honduras and its, you know, democracy has its roots in the coup. And Honduras, you know, has been struggling to build representative democracy, to fight corruption and crime. And what you had, you know, after the coup, you know, while the U.S. did, you know, cut assistance, it was very quick to reinstate assistance. It was a time when you also, with the U.S. failed drug policy, you had a shift in routes to Central America. Organized crime took advantage of the fact that, you know, the government had stopped functioning after the coup, particularly in rural areas where the country, you know, the government itself had very little presence. And that prompted, you know, very quickly re-engagement of U.S. You know, it fueled a significant amount of anti-drug aid that went to these corrupt governments. And as a result, you know, you've had, you know, a rising crime over the years, a rising corruption that has continued to just debilitate the system. And today, I would say, you know, Honduras, and Sarah Shea has greatly described this, you have, you know, a kleptocratic form of government where corruption is the operating system of Honduras. And that has had implications for the government not being able to address the many needs of the population, from security, education, health, addressing, you know, environmental disasters. Again, in a country that, as you know, has extremely high rates of poverty, particularly in the rural areas.
So your comment on... Go ahead, Juan.
Adriana, I wanted to ask you, the Biden administration has earmarked some $4 billion supposedly to combat the root causes of migration from Central America. Could you talk about, in view of all this corruption that exists, and people don't realize $4 billion in Central America is a lot of money. I mean, the entire budget of the national government of Honduras in 2020 was less than that, was $3.5 billion. So do you have fears that given the corrupt state of so many of these governments that this money will be stolen rather than actually used for its intended purpose?
Right. That's a great question. I mean, I think in Lara's piece brings this to light, is that corruption and weak governance have been and continue to be the main impediments to economic growth and improved security in Honduras and in much of the region. And until we address these issues, we are not going to see much reform, needed reforms, in the areas of, again, education, health, economic development, security. Now, the Biden administration, you know, from the get-go has said that they want to prioritize governance and tackling corruption. They launched the strategy, which, you know, illustrates this. But again, you know, the devil is in the details. As you say, you know, this includes learning from the past. And ensuring that if we are going to invest in the region, that we look at the long term. I think, you know, in the past, the U.S. has tended to focus on Central America wherever there's a crisis, and then we shift attention elsewhere. And that doesn't really allow us to help those that are pushing for reforms in these countries really address the root causes of corruption, of weak governance, of high rates of insecurity and crime. That includes also picking the right partners. And this goes to your question. There's a lot of concern in Congress here about the just epidemic levels of corruption that you see in the region, the continued backsliding of you know, advances that have been made in tackling impunity and corruption across the region, and in trying to ensure that assistance does not end up in the pockets of corrupt officials. There's been a big push to try to ensure that much of the aid goes to organizations, civil society, and to those voices that are committed to reform, that have been leading the efforts of reform. But I would say, you know, in the case of Honduras, like much of Central America, you know, for me, it's not just a question of aid, but a question of diplomacy and political efforts. And I do think that in order to tackle this epidemic corruption and weak governance, the Biden administration needs to use all its tools at its disposal to try to weaken and dismantle these illicit structures that have co-opted you know, the Honduran government and much of the institutions of other governments in the region.
Finally, Adriana, your message to the American people, when you look at the history of the United States, even going back, of course, before the U.S. supported the coup in Honduras in 2009, going back to, for example, and you could go further than this, but Honduras being the staging ground for the United States to illegally support the Contras in Nicaragua, toppling the Sandinista government, what that meant, then moving forward to supporting these literal drug traffickers in Honduras, and what this means for the Honduran people, and linking it to migration today.
Right. And you said it best, you know, the U.S. has throughout much of the history of the region supported abusive, corrupt governments. And other times it has, you know, because of its own, you know, interest in the region, look the other way and has not prioritized democracy, human rights and governance. And that's where we need to focus attention if we really want to help those that are risking their lives for reform in the region. You know, as Laura's piece, you know, beautifully describes, the, just the nexus between, you know, corruption and how it has contributed to migration. And the fact that, you know, when corruption reaches the top echelons of a government, what hope do people have that their needs are going to be met? What hope do people have that they're going to find, you know, a decent job, that their kids are going to be able to go to school without the fear that they're going to be, you know, attacked by gangs or drug trafficking?
Adriana, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Adriana Beltran, Executive Director of the Seattle International Foundation, and Laura Gottesdiener, our correspondent in Reuters Mexico and Central America Bureau. We will link to Laura's article, How a Drug Trafficking Mayor in Honduras Fueled the U.S. Migration Crisis. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkdine, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Sena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.